number of rethinking residencies. I get to be a member collective of New York-based residencies. And in 2021, we did a symposium, which went virtual, but it kind of ended up being a blessing. We got to be very close to have a wide reach because of it. And these are some of the thoughts that were sourced from that really awesome event. So first, I want to thank Karen Helmerson from NISCA. She's the program director that really supported this work. But then I'm going to pass it off to our two founders, Susan Hackett and Gary Plumpty.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I just want to say give a giant thank you to everybody who came this afternoon, and a big, big thank you to the three thinking residencies that I met over the years, supporting Bob's program director at New York City Council on the Arts, supporting the different nonprofits that are involved in this group. And at that time, I was originally supporting them on a one-to-one basis and learned that they had joined each other, I think about, 14 organizations? 14 organizations under the umbrella of three thinking residencies. And it occurred at the same time when program directors, funding directors at the council were really taking seriously that moment when artists were being revalued and re-studied, if you will, in terms of their economic challenges and wage and everything came about. So we were beginning to look very carefully at the care of artists. And this was, of course, in regard to the residencies that we were already supporting. That led to finding out the remarkable work that Rethinking was doing to encouraging a symposium. And that's kind of where I'm going to leave it, because I think that's why we're here, is they'll tell you the rest of the story. But it's an incredibly generous group. I want to thank them for all the support they've given me, frankly. And it's just a pure pleasure. So thank you all again. The support, you just don't know how important it is in all the different levels for all the people that are involved in work like this. So great. Enjoy.
Thank you all so much for coming. Thank you, Karen and Christina, for the introductions, and especially for the support of New York State Council for the Arts, who supported our 2021 symposium. There's many more people to thank, the team here at Bioneo Works for organizing today, and most especially all the Rethinking Residencies members, past and present. The group has been around since 2014, and over the years, there's probably been dozens of people involved in the group. And also thanks to the Vera List Center, who co-hosted our 2021 symposium. So as I mentioned, we founded Rethinking Residencies in 2014 to bring together residency organizations in New York, mostly to have discussions with each other and to exchange ideas and resources around residencies. And this initiative was founded with the idea that there's not enough critical discourse and exchange around residency programs. And so the group, you know, became very relevant very quickly for the members. And I think that its existence is just as critical now as it was then. And even in our first meeting, the idea of publishing a book was ignited, being that there was and still is very little publishing around residencies. And you can read more about the history and current working methods of rethinking residencies in the essay in the book that I co-authored with Nicholas Beast. So this is the first anthology on residencies in the United States. And I also think it's probably the publication that's involved the most art institutions collaborating together in New York. And we're very thrilled to be launching it today. Our new website also launched this morning, so please take a look at that. You can download a free ebook from our website, or there's a QR code at the book sales point. And it was very important for us to make this publication free and accessible to everyone. And so the foundation of the book is two panel transcripts from the 2021 symposium, but it really branches off from there. It's not completely based and grounded in the symposium, but the symposium was an impetus for many ideas that sprung forward afterwards that are in the book. And so there are 11 essays in addition to these two panel transcripts. And while all the essays are very diverse and cover different aspects and ideas around residencies, they are all very much bound together for a deep concern for the care and ethics that go into shaping residency programs and hosting artists and curators. I would like to introduce my co-editor, Susan Hapgood, who this book could not have happened without in so many ways. And she will be reading some excerpts from some of the essays in the book, and then I will do the same. And then we are lucky to have some of the contributors and also Rethinking Residencies members with us, who will discuss some of the topics that emerge out of the book.
Thank you. And thanks for all the thanks to everybody. I agree with all of them. So I will start with just the initial introduction where Carrie and I wrote about what the contents of the book are, and then I'll read two quick excerpts. Well, they're all excerpts. But, okay, so the publication begins with two histories of the Rethinking Residencies group in New York, and more broadly, residencies in 19th and 20th century Europe and the United States. Mutual Aid Practices Sustain Rethinking Residencies, a working group founded in 2014. Carrie Conti and Nicholas Wiest wrote about this group, the programs, initiatives, and events it has convened, and the non-hierarchical, self-organized structure of this, the first New York residency network. Hermeli Coco provides a foundational history of residencies as they relate to globalization and in light of her long-term engagement in the field. She maps how residency formats have evolved into what we know today, follows how they developed in tandem with art movements, and details how they have become increasingly significant for artists. And in looking forward, her text connects early rural artist colonies to the current demand for residencies located in nature. The second section features short texts and longer essays by members of Rethinking Residencies. Eileen Jang Lynch, who you will hear from later, recounts how new communities are formed through residencies, both in real life and virtually. Matt Rowe's short historical account of mixed-use buildings in New York City illuminates how architecture shapes residencies. I'm going to skip along for the sake of urgency. Residencies are sometimes conceived so that the public has direct day-to-day contact with artists in residence, as described by Christina Daniels, who introduced us. And then writing about guest and host complexities, Dylan Gauthier contemplates the malleability and reversal of such fixed categories in residency programs. Galen Joseph Hunter, who's also here, reflects on the delicate balance for artists between production and public programming in residencies. In the extended essays, Nova Benway and I address the often overlooked care issues in residency programs through the lenses of ethical frameworks and curatorial residencies. That child does not like this book. Three conversations form the third part of this publication. Two are condensed transcripts from the 2021 symposium and include a diverse range of viewpoints and positions from international speakers on residency programming and artistic support. A conversation between artists Merle Lederman-Euclides and Dylan Gauthier links UCLA's unprecedented 40-year residency with the City of New York Department of Sanitation to her work and to other residency structures. Finally, in residency's epistemologies, Viviana Cecchia draws on her personal experience as both a resident and a residency curator to outline what art research centers and residencies have in common and the profound potential for both to support artistic research. The publication ends with Tanya Kandiani's poetic text that I'm going to read a little bit of an excerpt from. And then I'm going to skip to the next part, which is I'm going to read from Carrie Conti and Nicholas Wies' History of Rethinking Residencies. We decided that the term working group most closely aligned with the values and undertakings of Rethinking Residencies, a group of specialists coming together for discussion and activities to achieve specific goals. Over the years, the group has met every few months, remaining informal, flexible, and mobile, with a non-hierarchical organizational structure. Rethinking Residencies functions somewhat like a co-op, a para-institution, or as one member remarked, an organism. And here we are nearly a decade later. While most working groups generally have shorter lifespans, the critical outcomes and collegiality inherent in Rethinking Residencies keep all member institutions engaged. The consistency and longevity of the group is also a testament to the need for more knowledge and resources for residency staff and the importance of our goals. 9 of the 10 organizations at the table for our first meeting have remained active participants. Rethinking Residencies culture is rooted in the desire to collaborate instead of compete, and our methods are modeled on mutual aid practices. We aim for transparency at every level, prioritize process over product, and encourage all participating individuals to assume a leadership stance. We recognize that a decentralized exchange of knowledge tends to uplift cultural actors working in parallel, while top-down circulation of best practices tends to narrow the field of possibility for our work by relying more and more on professionalization. Participating in Rethinking Residency is free and always has been. Production budgets for our public programs are fulfilled through grant writing and passing a hat. Well, and getting a major grant from NISCA. Constituent organizations may send whichever staff members they choose to meetings, generally one or two people. These individuals are not compensated for their work on behalf of the group. Nominations are held biannually for new member organizations. We limit the group's size using the two pizza theory of management. In other words, the size is right when two pizzas will satisfy one meeting, roughly speaking. And then, lastly, I just want to read an excerpt from Tanya Kanyani's text. She was a resident at our organization, ISCP, and she wrote a text called Temporary Studios, which is about residencies. And her points number 3 and 4 are my favorites. So, how am I doing on time? Okay. 3. The residencies as temporary laboratories of serendipitous encounters, the chance encounter. It's very poetic text, a lot of half sentences, but really evocative, I think. All right, here goes. Amplifying, in the acoustic sense, the possibility of the chance encounter, of play and chance. To take advantage of wandering, conversing, and snooping, and to understand everything as something newly discovered, the porous surface of the whole body in a perceptive, absorbing state. Extrapolated, heightened senses awakened to see or hear with all the senses, letting ourselves to be moved and amazed. Number 4, to start doing. A lot of walking is delightful, but we must find the discipline, organize the calendar, find the times of each day, the organization of the days based on the light, weather, ways of each place. Each residency has brought learning and has given new edges to my artistic practice and to me as a person. We are what we inhabit. We configure and are configured. Places adorn us. To refurnish the temporal reality in the mind and in space, create new calendars and times, let the body understand and accommodate to the new reality. To walk, to go out, to look for what the place has to find, promote serendipity, joy, and enjoyment. The opportunity to rewrite ourselves, to reconfigure ourselves, to work, to produce from the youth of a place, from the freshness of the newly discovered street. Let us displace and place ourselves, to cook for others, to bring a part of yourself to the table and share, the intrinsic generosity of our circumstance, to respond to it with an attentive and sensitive ear, the constant possibility of mutual learning, freshness, improvisation, unfazed joy.
In Vidyanam Chachia's text, she writes about the relationships between research centers and art residencies. On page 110, the art residency offers the condition for that research phase and for the continuum to appear. In an art world operating at a very high speed, the residency offers a possible moment of calm and intellectual meditation. This temporality differs greatly from the conventions of time pressure and delivery attendant in normative academic research enterprises. Within the art residency mode, opportunity and funding are most commonly distributed with no stipulations on research objectives or deliverables beyond the obligation to research. This environment recreates some interesting conditions of freedom that are rarely offered to practitioners in the arts as they develop their professional practice. And this dimension of time, perhaps more particular to the art residency than the art research center, seems central to free play and generative knowledge exploration and production. Susan Hapgood, in her essay, argues for the importance of curatorial residencies from page 40. So programs encourage research, which may entail accessing local resources, archives, artistic communities, or specific collections. For a curator working on a forthcoming exhibition or publication, this can be a period of intensive study away from home. Nearly all curatorial residencies stress immersion in differing cultures and in local artistic communities, emphasizing the opportunity to establish new relationships with arts professionals. Whether this activity is characterized as networking or as cultural discourse and exchange, the host institution is often motivated to encourage new collaboration, to foster recognition, and potential opportunity for local artists to present their work in differing contexts and places. And finally, in a conversation between Meryl Latterman Euclides and Dylan Gauthier about Meryl's 40-year residence at the Department of Sanitation, New York, at the end of the conversation, I quote, page 105, Dylan says, "What else could municipalities or residencies do to support artists better?" Meryl says, "There's so much to do. Also, there are random vacant spaces in big agencies. So Stolen has parked himself in the Sumter repair shop of Sanitation Department. Sanitation's main repair shop, it's as big as the Empire State Building. My mirrored garbage truck is there. I have my art and my ceremonial arches in another section. I have a container there even. These are largely places that a lot of sanitation forgot about. So he's creating spaces, finding stuff, and bringing stuff back that people forgot about. So he's bringing like his whole world into this fabulous, you know, multiple worlds." Yeah, that's what residencies can enable, this bringing worlds together. And that's what we take the title of the book from. And Dylan says, "That's a good subtitle for this piece or the whole symposium. I wish you had said that earlier." And there we took the title. And Meryl says, "It's important to give artists a feeling like there are places out there for them to grow. It's so important, especially now when things are so expensive and it's difficult for artists to make this work. I'm so glad you're working on it." So with that, I would like to hand it over to Matt Rowe and Eileen Jane Lynch, both contributors to the book, who will speak about building communities and residencies.
Thank you. Thank you so much, everybody, for being here today. I'm Matt Rowe, I'm the Executive Director of Flux Factory.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much also for being here today. I'm Eileen Jane Lynch. I was the former Senior Curator of Visual Arts at Wave Hill when I wrote this essay, and I'm the current Director of Curatorial Programs at the Bronx Museum. So, hi, Matt.
Hello. And our essays are nestled next to each other in this book. And so we just prepared a few questions for each other to just bring out some of the points. Can I ask the first one? Do you mind? Thank you so much. So you spoke, and I imagine COVID informed some of this, that community building can happen both through the staff facilitation, but also just organic ways at residencies happening in person. But then you also spent a few paragraphs talking about how the internet has really, expanded how these communities can build. And we're in this moment now where we're trying to, hopefully we've learned a few lessons over the last few years and adapted residencies in ways that are permanent and not just reacting, happenstance to the conditions immediately around us. And so I just wanted to hear if you reflect a little bit on how you integrate the online and the IRL community building and residencies.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, sometimes community building isn't necessarily the first goal of residency programs, but it certainly is something that happens and very important. And so as we learned, especially in the pandemic, Wave Hill originally had, only in-person residency program, so it's called the Winter Workspace. And so as the pandemic continued, it was almost imperative to think about a more hybrid approach. And so because if we couldn't have a social distance or not be able to be together in one space closely, how do you mitigate that? And so we provided the opportunity. They provided the opportunity to also have virtual programming. So there were virtual office hours, once a week. And then also it provided opportunities, let's say if an artist had a disability and couldn't be on site, it also offered a virtual residency or studio space for an artist. And so I think it's really important to be able to balance the two. Certainly in-person interaction and these organic conversations, these serendipitous conversations that happen are important, but then you can also open it up with these kind of virtual programs and have even more people participate if you can't be on site. So I think it's a gentle balance in that way, and then to help facilitate those also are important as well. And then I want to ask you, Nat, in the same vein, your essay is on mixed-use spaces. And so if you can kind of elaborate a little bit about that, because it's about providing the physical infrastructure for artists to convene and to build community and to build and have these dialogues of creativity together. And so do you see that more as the conversations, the community building happening more organically, or do you facilitate it in some way?
Yeah, it is a funny question of what the staff role is, because my essay draws from personal experiences that I've had over the last 15 years or so, working with artist-led spaces where the staff is not precisely a leader, it's maybe a little bit more just giving the support so that the artists can lead themselves. I realized at a certain point that working in post-industrial spaces, mixed-use spaces, which is such a long tradition in New York City, as I started to see these spaces being phased out and not really being feasible, I noticed that there was a different way that people were getting together in those kinds of spaces. And so, I kind of started to think about how we choose how to build these, you know, every architectural choice is coming from our minds. And then it also influences the way that we interact with each other. And so, you know, I'm one of those people who's complaining about how New York used to be better back in the day. You know, it's not precisely the most optimistic essay. But I do have to say, you know, Pioneer Works is a good example of the kind of normative, you know, argument that I was making about what residency spaces should seek to do, where, you know, these are residency spaces right here, and you have a line of sight directly down to an exhibition space, and all of these different kinds of things that people do, all the different parts of our lives, become connected in a dreamlike way when a space does all these different kinds of things. And so if you kind of break down the literal walls between those uses, then, you know, things connect and reconnect in weird ways, and it sort of fosters community building, and also just like the way that you're going about thinking about your day-to-day life changes a lot. And, you know, for me, the residency becomes more enriching because of that. The people inside of it change and grow in unexpected ways.
And then, like, breaking down walls, like here, the residencies, I love that the doors are just all windows, right? So, mm-hmm. not windows, but they're not barriers in a sense. So you can, like, see the artists working in their space, and you can go in and, you know, have it. It's more, it seems like more open-minded in that way. It facilitates the conversation.
And we've sort of touched on this question a little bit, but what, when you were, working, facilitating this residency, what did you see as your role? Because it's sort of all about the artists, in a sense, we're sort of there to serve them in a way, but also, like, leadership is important, and, you know, so how did you find yourself dealing with that, with Helen, you know, what, particularly with community building? You know, how did you go about that? You know, was it just sort of laissez-faire and see what the artists come up with? Or, when did you take an active hand?
I mean, I think even in Gabriel and Rachel, please feel free to chime in. I feel like even when we were during the selection process, you know, we're thinking about community building and selecting the artists. So it's six artists per six-week session. And, you know, who would have an interesting dialogue among each other, especially like thinking about artists working in different mediums as well. So ranging from, you know, painting to photography to performance, like, you know, running the whole gamut and developing like cohorts that way. And then also like as administrative staff, I feel like we, you know, let the artists know that we're there to help them in any way possible, whether it's the like Xerox, you know, images or printout images, but there's like a fine line where, you know, we're there, but then we're not like kind of always in their face. Like they have their own studio space to do work. And then when they need us, they know where to find the staff. And then there are facilitated conversations like, you know, gets like pizza lunches, or, you know, facilitating artists to do like studio visits with each other, or having like, guest visitors come in, or having the public come in and see what they're working on, and even the cumulative open studios at the end of each session. And so I think it's about managing expectations, and so letting the artists know like, hey, we're here to help you in whatever way you need, but you're also free to do, you know, whatever work you need, and then, and so like everyone's on the same page as to like what to expect.
Yeah, I've sort of used the buffet metaphor a little bit for residencies, where every artist is gonna need something different, and you're not really gonna know what it is. And even maybe when the artist applied, you know, and then comes to the residency a year later, you know, maybe what they expected to need isn't what they happened to need that day. So it really, you really have to be reflexive and have a pretty wide toolkit to be able to do that kind of work.
I mean, what's the structure like at a Flux Factory for your residencies?
It really is. I mean, it's a little bit like that where, what do you need? Do you need visa support? Do you need funding? You know, do all right with that one. not as well as I would like. You know, sometimes I've heard many of ours, this is their first opportunity to exhibit in New York City, and really what they want to do, their residency is just leading up to an exhibition opportunity. Sometimes they're new to town and want to meet people, want to get connected into the city, and so we really, you know, part of what we do, we link local and international and national people together, and so, you know, that many people look for that at the Flux residency. You know, sometimes we have a decent variety of tools and kind of fabrication spaces, so some artists don't use any of that. You know, sometimes they don't use the wood shop at all, but then sometimes they, you know, learned to work with wood there and they didn't even realize until they kind of got into it their second week of the residency. So I don't know how to do this in an effective way where you're sort of, you know, having a mold of what the residents are supposed to fit into. It really, the way it always seems to work best is when the artist is sort of figuring out what they need to do that day. It does lead to a bit of a jack of all trades thing where we're kind of, you know, the problem it sets for us is we're like a little bit mediocre at everything and always trying to get better. You know, it's like just spread so thin. So that is certainly a drawback of this approach. And there are probably other, you know, residencies, you know, that have a more targeted approach. So, you know, I think that could be really excellent. Doing one thing well, it's a great philosophy. It's just not what Flux does at all.
The opportunity for them to have their hands in so many different things.
Yeah.
It's not something that they can find everywhere.
No. And, you know, I mean, with emerging artists, I mean, basically have to, you know, most of these people are experimenting and figuring things out. I think most of the Rethink residency is organizations are working with people at a pretty early career stage, and so, you know, they're developing their, you know, their thesis, and later on you'll see, oh, that project they did now, that's their thing, that's their niche that they own years later.
Yeah, that's very exciting to see, and another thing is, you know, we felt to emphasize that, you know, it's not about the end product or the, you know, the finished work. It's about process, right? And experimentation, and like take the chance and the opportunity while you're in this beautiful garden to experiment in any way that you can and learn from the, you know, the whole horticulture team and staff or the education team. And so really, and it could lead to, like you said, so many different, you know, avenues of thinking, and you can see that, I think, through all the organizations, like how it has an impact on artists' work even moving forward. So, and I have a question for you now. So you said, you know, you often long for like old New York, the large industrial spaces, and so yeah, I mean, like, certainly agree with where we are now. But I'm just curious, like, what are some, without necessarily always having access to that large space and having the mixed use space, I know there are like long-term uses out there for like, there's what's it called, ArtSpace PS109, where it's like live workspace for creatives, but it's long-term, not short-term, like residency. So I'm just curious, what do you propose as solutions for creating mixed use spaces, and what are you imagining, like, buying this guy?
Yeah, I mean, it's less possible in New York than it used to be, and it's really a very sad thing about this city. You know, and I think for many people, it's kind of better to be an artist elsewhere, because, you know, for me, like, looking back at my own experience and the experiences of people, you know, many people that I know, you needed a no-budget way to do things where there's kind of no definition of failure or success. And that's like how you know, that's such an important way to develop new ideas and to become creative. And so there's this problem where we're over-professionalized in New York City, where the artists have to do something that's going to work, And you know, you don't even have to have the space to store paintings that are unsold. It's a huge, people are always swirling their paintings into hallways and stuff because they can't put them in the studios. You know, so it really is.
It's a lot of pressure.
Well, I'm ending on a negative note here. It's I think institutions, have to step up to provide that affordable space, the tools, and just so that the artists can have a totally, free way to experiment. Because that's what made New York City this, incredible cultural hub that explores so many ideas around the world. And it's sort of, we're losing that magic, I fear, with, mostly the affordability crisis. Sure, yes, we are at time.
Okay. Thank you.
Talk about supporting the whole artist, care, and accessibility in residencies.
Hello, there we go. Thank you for joining us. I'm Karina Reddy. I am managing the session program at Recess, and the session program is sort of an unconventional residency. We only have one resident at a time, then but a couple of months in our space to sort of completely create a interactive space for engagement with the public in those 2 months. And the idea is that they do apply already with a project in mind. There's a lot of flexibility to change how that manifests itself. But it is specifically for people who want to reach and have an idea of a community of people that this project is for and can serve. We ask also artists to identify sort of narrative change work that they're, social narrative change work that they're interested in engaging with. And we ask artists that this be sort of on the learning edge, that there's a piece of risks in terms of methodology, in terms of not just the mediums and tools that they're using, but how they want to engage a public and how they can get more comfortable with putting stuff out that's not perfect. Matt, you're saying one of the problems of this pressures of New York is that you don't put anything out in the public until it's perfect, right? Until the exhibition is ready, until you've had all of the sort of behind closed doors criticism, etc. And I think that the sort of what we lose from that is that artists are very scared to make mistakes, scared to engage the public, scared to have critique and no one has their back, scared to sort of say, oh, I need to learn these new skills and I'm just testing them out, right? And this is how artists grow. And so Recess was sort of created this opportunity specifically for that, for artists to take a break from that treadmill of one exhibition to the other or one residency to the other where you're just sort of about producing work. And so what if we took that away and we resourced really that sense of learning new things, trying out new things, and being comfortable engaging the public in whatever crazy idea that you have that will lead towards more care in the world, that would lead to more social justice in the world, that would lead to a sense of a broadening of who, not only who artists are, but who art audiences or participants were. So that's sort of, it's a very particular sort of residency that already has all this structure. And I came to it at the end of 2021, so just a year and a half ago. So it was a sort of strange moment to come out of it because, we're coming out of Delta. We didn't know we were gonna head into Omicron quite yet. And so I thought I was starting when we were tentatively becoming more public again. And, this was an exciting moment to sort of be able to have the residencies engage the public again in a physical way, as much as possible, or in a hybrid way, or you know, whatever way that felt safe at the moment. But that was important. The other thing I would say that's very different about Recess is that our artist community is not limited to the artists in our session program. We also have creative writers that work to document those projects. We also have a program for systems impacted young adults. Generally, sort of this, you know, we're an abolitionist organization that believes that, you know, we need to move towards a non-punishment-based society, and that we need to find ways to create community safety that doesn't rely on surveillance or punishment or carceral tactics. So, you know, part of this is that we have a community of young people who we describe as part of our artist community. They are learning art, they are also learning somatic tools. They are coming with a lot of trauma, and that's part of who we have to take care of too, and not just the artists that are coming through our open call. And so in terms of like what we're talking about here, the two of us, about care and access, that's sort of the topic that the two of us are engaging. And I don't have anything in here because the timing just worked out when I was just starting. And I just came in after the symposium was done. But I do think that Recess definitely has been challenging itself, you know, to like, how do we hold all of these communities together with very different needs, with very different art experiences under their belt, and with varying levels of you know, trauma that they're dealing with and insecurity that they're dealing with. So I'll mention a couple of things that have been started before I came, and then and one thing which I'm sort of shepherding into the future. But one thing that Recess started, because we have so many folks who are living sort of paycheck to paycheck, right? You know, in all of those buckets of community members and artists. And so we have an emergency fund. So, you know, it's not a huge emergency fund. It's like let's put away $30,000, $40,000, whatever we can that's in excess of like the cost of our programs and our staff, and put it away in this emergency fund that people can ask for, you know, up to $5,000. To pay rent, to pay, you know, hospital bills, whatever it is. And that was particularly important during the pandemic. We also got this unexpected windfall from Mackenzie Scott in 2020. Which was, you know, it's not something you apply for. Mackenzie Scott was Jeff Bezos's ex-wife, who was giving out money and giving away money, especially in that's general operating money, no strings attached. And we got $2 million. We're like, what are we gonna do with this $2 million? And so we created a committee of folks from the, you know, the young people, the writers, the artists, to decide what we were gonna do with it. And we had them go through a process with an outside facilitator. And what they decided to do with half, what they decided to do is to create a community bank for Recess community members in perpetuity. And half of that money was given as a one-time cash distribution, and half that money is being saved for a community bank. So anybody who's gone through the Recess, like staff, artists, et cetera, are part of the Recess community, and we're still figuring out how people will access the community bank. But, you know, it was interesting to see that like people were offered a, you know, like an equal share, and people could take it, they could say they didn't need it, or they could ask for less or more. And amazingly, in this experiment, it evened out to about the amount of money that we had. And I think that is also a basis of trust, a basis of a sense of like when you're being called to be into community. You know, and people are like, well, does this count? Does this count? I was like, I'm not making that judgment. You know, if you need to do it to, you know, cover base necessities in your life, that's fine. If you need to do it because you need time to write a book, that's fine. But it's up to you. You make the choice. You know who the community is. And the third thing that I'll mention, and we can talk about later how it's evolved, maybe, because I know I'm taking up a lot of time, I don't have to talk yet, but is something that was called a peer circle, which came about during the pandemic when folks were super isolated. And the idea was to surround the artists and to have a pot of money to pay for people to identify a circle of care. And that could include RECESS staff members, alumni, board members, but also people in their own network that they wanted to have some sort of structured interaction with that would check in with them, that would help them answer questions, both existential and logistical, you know, whatever people wanted and however they wanted to do it. And I will say that what I realized was that that was really challenging because it felt like in addition to the project they had to make, they had to manage this whole other like set of people. And so sometimes our care ideas actually add more work. So I have to say that, and to say that we're still working on that. So with that, I'm gonna pass it on to Nova Benwaiters, who does have an article in here to talk from Triangle, to talk about your experiences around access and care.
Yeah, thank you so much, Karana. That was amazing, and I'm a huge admirer of RECESS and your work, and it's evolved so much just in the last year and a half since you've been there that it feels like you've been there longer, so even that is kind of amazing to hear, but it's been kind of such a short time. I'm the director of Triangle Arts Association, which is a residency in Dumbo. We're kind of right under the Manhattan Bridge. And it's interesting, I was trying to think of the word to describe us kind of in relation to RECESS since we were talking today, and I was gonna say traditional, or I even came up with like white cube, which is sort of weird because it's not usually like residencies, and you said RECESS is unconventional. I would say, without being derogatory toward us, we're sort of conventional in some way. Anyone can apply. What we provide is usually 3 months of studio space. The space is very open. There's, you know, what's provided are like the traditional things you would think of that an artist might need in their studio. And we do, you know, bring in curators and people to give feedback. We have kind of like field trips that we do with the artists, take them places. But in general, I guess you could say it's the kind of thing that many artists across the board, regardless of where they are in their career or, you know, where they are in their lives, might want. And so that, in a funny way, is where I came from in thinking about the writing that I did for this text, because I think a lot of the time, conversations around access, around care, get situated in these amazing and admirable and like very courageous initiatives undertaken by programs like RECESS, where you know you can point to specific communities that you're working with. And so I sort of took myself to task. And actually my essay, I feel like, is a little bit, I don't know if you would say putting the cart before the horse or some kind of metaphor like that, because it's actually about a lot of work that isn't done in some way, and I'm sort of speaking to, speaking in relation to programs like RECESS, but speaking to programs like mine, where again, you know, sort of anybody can apply, and there's this sense of, what's the word, like almost, again, I'm thinking of like derogatory words, like generic and things like that, which is not what I mean, I just mean that it's, you know, very kind of, like the sense of it is that it's sort of for everyone, but, you know, is it? And there's a big question mark around. So one of the things I thought about a lot in relation to this book was the situatedness of residencies in the art world where, you know, implicitly or very explicitly, we are advocates for care for artists, care for the whole artist. And that's another way in which I feel very grateful as someone, as a professional in the residencies here for organizations like RECESS, because I think they are kind of leading the way, but I think it often is kind of, that question of care is kind of situated within the residency, so we provide care to artists once they come to us. And one of the things I was just sort of trying out and thinking experimentally in the essay that I wrote was this question of hospitality, generosity, which I think, you know, residencies do a lot to advocate for in, I don't want to say in contrast to museums or galleries and things like that, but you know, that's like the thing that we're advocating for as a field. But this sort of question around where hospitality and generosity can move toward solidarity and what it means for an organization to be in solidarity with artists or perhaps even with other groups or entities that, that would be something to sort of even think further beyond. But the kind of analogy that I draw in the essay is related to medical care, where, much as we, as particularly organizations like mine, where we do an open call, we get 1,000 applications, we only accept 20, and then when those 20 artists come to us, I'd like to think that we treat them very well, and we are sort of models for care in many ways, but in what way are we addressing this general condition of scarcity that is so incredibly present in everything that we do? And I'm thinking about it even more deeply now because we just completed an open call where we had a question about, we evaluate merit, which is a very contentious issue, based on the work, and then we also have a question related to need. And, everybody needs studio space. There's no easy way to evaluate that.
When I draw from an analogy from a writer who writes around sort of medical care and from a justice lens, and the question is, for those who are able, for whatever reason in their lives, they have the privilege of being able to access medical care in America, they need to get very good care. And doctors have that sort of relationship to that, where they provide that care. But when we think about all of the many, 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 many people in this country who don't have that access, doctors sort of have no relationship to them. And it's very interesting to see when doctors kind of step out of that role of sort of Hippocratic oath, sort of individual relationship with patients, and become advocates for, Medicare for all and these kinds of things. What's the point where the work becomes political, where it takes on an advocacy role? So I'm the one who's talking too much, so I'll kind of wrap up. But I guess what I want to pose as a question, thank you. And I'm looking over here, so I'm also like, what I want to pose as a question is how we can find, and I think Recess is really working on this line in so many beautiful ways, but we're not a housing organization, but how do we relate to the affordability crisis in this city in particular, in this country? I don't think that means that we should become an organization that focuses on housing affordability advocacy, but what is our, it's sort of about solidarity around those kinds of questions. So I don't have answers, which just makes it easy for me to stop. maybe I'll stop there. And
Well, we do have a Q&A afterwards, so if people want to
hear more about it.
Thank you.
So lastly in our conversations, I'd like to introduce Galen Joseph Hunter and Isabel B. Saldana, who will talk about public-private programming and balancing that in residencies.
Hi there. So I'm Galen Joseph Hunter. I'm the executive director of Wave Farm. And
I'm Issa Saldana. I'm the senior manager of artist development at the Longfat Project in Bed-Stuy.
And we have the great fortune of being last, and we've been running long, so we get to be really concise. But it's actually, I think, the idea of public and private, following the conversations we've heard already, is I'm glad we're last. Because when I think about issues of in the private of residencies, I think about care for the artists that we're serving. And then when I think about what public means, public engagement, it's about community access and community building. I'm struck by how different all of the 14 organizations that are members of Rethinking Residencies are and how different our programs are. But as a group of individuals working to support these artists in these programs, we have so much in common. So there are a lot of interesting ways, I think, that organizations tackle the challenge or the opportunities in both serving an artist first and foremost and what their needs are while in residence, and then what is the public engagement piece. So that may be tied intrinsically to an organization's mission. That may be a pressure applied on an organization as part of a government funding opportunity. But how does one balance that? And it's interesting, we're sitting here on a second Sundays where the public is invited in to witness artists at work with glass fronts to their studios. So that's one approach, clearly. And I was struck by Nat's discussion about the buffet for resident artists, and I think that that's how Wave Farm approaches things. So Wave Farm is our northernmost member of Rethinking Residencies. We're about 2.5 hours north of the city in in the Upper Hudson Valley, we say. And we are located on 29 acres in a town called Caro, which is very red politically. We have one artist at a time that come and literally is in residence with us, so they're becoming a temporary member of that community. And we think a lot about what does that mean? How do we prepare an artist to enter a community where there might be signage that is alarming or offensive they encounter? What is our responsibility for bringing artists into a small community in that way, and what does that engagement look like? So some of the strategies we've employed are optional public workshops for our artists. They're not required to propose one, but if they want to try and bring people in that way, we do that. We do live performance at partnering venues in some cases. We have an art park on 29 acres, so we have public tours and our visitors engage with our residents. And then kind of our most successful, I think, solution is that we also have a public radio station. And so each of our residencies culminates with a 2-hour broadcast where the artist is sharing their work to intentional and unintentional audiences, because in a rural community, people are hitting scan on their radio dials and encountering this work, maybe by accident, often by accident. And we're also reaching incarcerated populations in many upstate prisons, et cetera. Isabel and I were thinking that we would try to get some audience involvement, and we wanted to know if anybody had other ideas or experiences in terms of this public engagement piece. Do you want to ask them that now, or do you want to talk about Laundromat in a moment?
I can talk a little bit about the LGBT, can marinate on that, and especially we're interested in hearing from folks in the room who might be artists yourselves and have had various relationships to dealing with or interacting with different kinds of publics. You could be administrators, and we're sort of interested in how you set artists up or communities up for that work, or you could be part of those publics. So. As you chew on that, I'll talk a little bit about the LP. For those who aren't familiar with us, we are an organization that believes in artists and neighbors pairing together to create social change. And we were founded in the late 1990s, early 2000s, when at the time there weren't any organizations, like formal organizations, really working in the space of community engagement, residencies for artists of color specifically, and Black and Brown artists even more specifically. And so that's been our work since 1996-ish, when our founder, Risa Wilson, started to think about what it meant to have art and the access to creative space in away from galleries, museums, and public engagement spaces that require leisure time or admission fees, and instead have them in places where people already are, such as laundromats, hence the name of the Laundromat Project. And when we think about public-private, I think one thing that's really interesting is that it's almost from a different lens than many other residency programs or organizations, in that we're actually thinking about how do we maintain our public's privacy, because for us, our publics are our communities, our Black and Brown folks who are often over-surveilled already, and whose communities are often ravaged by other people's theories of change coming into their communities. So we recently, in 2020, signed a 10-year lease back in Bed-Stuy after having been across New York in the Bronx, Harlem, and Bed-Stuy, and not really having one central home, and returned to having one anchor neighborhood. And as a result, we've really focused on what does it look like to be able to have our theory of change be informed by our neighbors. And so our artist projects don't exist without the public, if that makes sense. And in some ways, it's more important to us to maintain a relationship with the public where there's trust between us and them, for us to even introduce an artist to them, to be able to engage. And I think that sometimes that's a little bit different from what other residencies are thinking about. It's about giving the public a chance to access the artist, as opposed to, for us, giving the artist a chance to access our public through the relationships we're building. So it's just like a little bit of a turn in terms of how we think about it, but I think it informs a lot of what we do, and it makes it so that our community engagement programming is now becoming hand in hand with our residency programming, so that they're not really two separate entities. They're really seen as, the training is for the artists to be able to think and act that way within their own practice. So I'll pause there. Curious if folks have any creative solutions or problems that they've run into with publics and private.
And I don't know if we have a few minutes or that becomes the Q&A.
Yeah.
Maybe.
So. I think maybe we can include that in a Q&A.
Yeah, absolutely.
Comments and take a few more minutes.
Yeah.
But you can moderate it. It's fine.
Oh. Does anyone? Yeah.
It also doesn't have to be a response to that question if you had a question from earlier.
Yeah. All questions welcome for any of the presenters.
Can I ask about the community, the thing you were just talking about? Can you give an example of a situation where the community was ready for the artist and how it unfolded?
Tell me what you mean by ready.
Well, I don't. You said that you have to decide whether or not you're going to give the artist access to your community.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just asking for an example because, you know, we are an institution that's doing the opposite, mm-hmm. just as you pointed out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think I can think about, so with the Laundromat Project, we have two ways through our Create Change program, and one is a fellowship, one is a residency. Usually our artists and residents sort of have a socially engaged practice already, but our fellows do not. And so they go through a curriculum, and it's not until they go through that curriculum that they're allowed to, or that we ask them to start really coming up with a project. And even in the process of coming up with that project, we first hear where they're at in terms of how much they understand the community they've identified they want to work with, whether it's a specific demographic, a specific geographic location, like what is the connection? And then we go through our networks and see, is there someone who makes sense for this group? And I'll give an example from our most recent fellows cohort. There was a group who wanted to work with folks working in wellness for Black people in Bed-Stuy, and so there's a organization called Life Wellness Center that we had connections with, but who really were like, this is not what we do. We don't work with arts organizations. It will throw off our workers' schedules, like, to take up space. Like, we need our clients to be able to use this space. And so being able for them to have enough dialogue to figure out a program where they could still bring their ideas and their projects, but they were really listening to the needs of the space first. And I think that's the sign of readiness of, like, if you're really able to do that, then we can help support you in moving this project forward. But if you're not able to sort of demonstrate that you can put what you presume to be the necessary project on the back burner and first listen to what the community organization is saying, they want or they need or they've seen, you know, other folks identify as a need, then we're going to have to pair you with someone else, and we would explore what that would look like. Does that answer your question?
Totally. Thank you.
Yeah.
I think that's so much of what residency programs do is facilitation in all these different permutations. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, yeah. Any other questions? Carrie and Susan, as our editors, do you want to say a final word?
Sure. Well, you can stick around a little bit longer and have some more informal conversation. I want to thank everyone for being here, and especially for everyone who spoke today in the conversations. It was really enlightening, and you touched on issues both in the book but not in the book, so I think we have another book to do now. actually, on that note, the book is mainly accessible via digital copy, but we only printed 250 copies on Rhizograph that Shindigan Projects printed. So I highly encourage anyone who's like a bookophile who likes objects and books to buy it today, because it may be your only opportunity. And then also Nat won't have to carry them all back to Flux Factory. But you'll be able to access them in libraries and online, et cetera, as well. So thank you all so much. Thanks.